Come on aboard, I promise you. Lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, welcome into another episode of The Bandwagon. I'm Brian Moline.
John Steinbacher.
Travis Tate.
You'll notice the voice that's absent is one Lisa Brautz. She is enjoying the sun down in Florida this week. Although, hey, we're having some sunshine here this week. It's not too awfully bad for February, but I imagine it's a little warmer where Lisa is at the moment. And maybe a little more outdoor activity possible down in the great state of Florida.
It's supposed to be in the 60s this weekend here, though.
It is. It is. So I guess all things considered, we won't complain too much about this February's weather here in East Central Illinois. But without Lisa, it's going to be the three of us on the bandwagon this week. We've got a fun show in store for you today. We'll talk about athletes getting hurt off the field, some of the more infamous off-field athlete injuries over the years, including one that just has happened this week. We'll discuss that coming up in just a moment. We'll talk a little bit about commissioners in professional sports. Does anybody actually like them, for one? And talk about some of the different commissioners around professional sports and how they handle their particular leagues a little bit differently than others. Elsewhere, the Utah Jazz have recently become a trust after a change in ownership. We'll kind of take a look at that ownership situation. Now, Travis has all the details there. Travis also has the rivalry this week, which will focus again on the state of Utah. So we're counting on UT Dog to do some heavy lifting for us today.
Oh, you a lot know, of you, Utah talk.
You know about the rivalry already?
He just told me.
I gave him a spoiler alert. So you're not going to know.
Yeah, you don't know. Man.
Brian knows.
But I do. How do you like that, John?
Typical,
fierce,
standard operating procedure.
Savage.
Well, I'm a reporter. I've got to dig for the inside information, and I got it.
Okay.
So there you go. Let's get things started with a little talk about off-field injuries. And John, there was a pretty good one that just popped up across the news wires this week.
There is Kansas City Royals pitcher Brian Flynn was going to report to spring training this week. Pitchers and catchers reporting this
yes.
week, so that's a great sign that spring is soon here and exciting times for those of us whose other sports have left us miserable this off season. Illini basketball. All right, I won't go into it. Anyway, his name is Brian Flynn, and he crashed through the roof of a barn at his home in McAlester, Oklahoma, breaking a rib and sustaining 3 non-displaced fractures in his vertebrae. He will be out for 8 weeks. I'm impressed that they think he'll be back in 8 weeks with those injuries, but yeah.
So is this fell through a roof in quotes, or do we actually think he fell through a roof?
I want to see the hole in that barn.
Yeah, was this caught on YouTube by chance? I that is something that is just almost – it's one of those that – is so crazy that it almost has to be true. I mean, who would make up a story about falling through a barn roof?
He says that he hasn't discussed it publicly yet, but in an earlier conversation...
He's probably in bed still.
He didn't talk about discomfort, and he talked positively about his off-season. He got married. He moved to McAlester. I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of weird. Why was he up on the roof of the barn?
I don't know. Maybe doing a little shingle work?
Yeah. Anyway, but
some of those baseball pitchers, Madison Bumgarner, I think he would do this type of hard manual labor.
I think that's kind of part of
the off season.
Right.
Yeah.
Jake Arrieta goes on hikes with his kids carrying stuff
and does insane amounts of Pilates. That's the Jake Arrieta MO.
So, you know, like you mentioned, this is not an uncommon. Well, it's not uncommon to have weird injuries. Just October?
Mm-hmm.
Trevor Bauer, is that his name?
Yeah, from the Cleveland Indians.
He got an injury from, what was it?
He was fixing his drone. He was trying to repair a drone. That's not a euphemism.
Okay.
He was actually trying to repair a drone and cut his finger. And if you watched, I think it was the American League Division Series when he tried to pitch against Toronto. And he made it like an inning, I think. And it was just blood was
the
just
blood
gushing.
Is pouring.
Yeah, just gushing out of his finger. He should not have been trying to throw. And like he made it for like, I don't know, a few batters. And then every time he threw the baseball, there was blood all over it. And finally, I think it was the Toronto manager's like, guys, we can't keep
this is a bad idea.
This. Yeah, so the umpire made him leave the game.
Even though it's the playoffs, you got to just know when to sit down.
Yeah.
And if your finger is falling off, essentially, it's time to not pitch anymore.
Yeah, so that was another good recent example. The first one I really remember very vividly with all this was back in 2002, Jeff Kent, who by many accounts was kind of a jerk anyway, was at spring training for the San Francisco Giants. And so he broke his wrist. And apparently the story was that he did it while washing his truck. So he likes to, you know, likes to drive his truck around, likes to wash it himself when he needs to. But the problem is a group of eyewitnesses came forward. They had seen Jeff Kent on the day of his injury, not at a do-it-yourself car wash, as he claimed, but no, they'd seen a man matching Kent's description on a stretch of highway on a motorcycle doing stunts like popping wheelies.
Wow.
The reason that's a problem for Jeff Kent is because, well, in his contract, he wasn't supposed to be doing such things. Now, as I understand it here, he didn't miss that much of the season. He only missed four games, had a very good year. And so he didn't get docked pay or anything like that. It was just a very embarrassing thing for Jeff Kent.
The couple that I want to point out would be, and you guys are Cubs fans, so you would remember this one more than I would, but Sammy Sosa,
yeah,
his famous sneeze, which did something to his back, and he sat out for a while.
Yeah.
Pulled a ligament or something, yeah.
Yeah. And then a more recent example was a couple of off seasons ago in the NFL, Jason Pierre-Paul had an issue with some fireworks during the 4th of July, essentially blew up his hand. This was like the talk of ESPN and all the NFL shows all over the place. You know, how much is he going to be docked from his contract? I think maybe he had just signed a contract or something.
Now, did the contract, do we know, did it explicitly say you can't handle fireworks? Or is it just, is there, that's what I mentioned.
I'm going to have my lawyer get back to you on that one. I'm not sure.
Or is it the general don't do anything stupid clause in the contract?
And I think it might be more so based on whatever kind of insurance situation there is.
Right.
The team is probably not, you know, going to be held
for fireworks. There.
Right. Yeah. But that's interesting that, you know, all it takes is sort of a problem with a drone and you mess up your finger and that really causes a problem as a baseball player because especially if that's your pitching hand, but Jason Pierre-Paul, I believe, played half that season or something with just essentially a giant club on his hand, which probably did
worked well for him. Yeah.
Only helped him as he could just club offensive linemen in the head or hit him in the ribs. Yeah, so that's a interesting problem that he had.
Yeah,
I learned of one I didn't know since you brought up the Cubs, Cardinals, Vince Coleman, during his rookie year. Actually, this happened in right before Game 4 of the in 1985 NLCS.
The tarp.
He got ran over by the tarp as it was coming out, right?
Yeah.
And this is funny because he just set a record for stealing 110 bases. And they say the tarp,
most by a rookie, yeah.
Yeah, the tarp goes at 2.5 miles per hour.
he was just sitting there, I think, stretching when it happened, as I recall.
Should have been able to outrun it still.
Yeah.
Get up.
Yeah.
You know, get out of the way.
And then the Cardinals went on to lose the World Series to the Royals that year. So that's a injury that I'm sure directly affected them. You know, he certainly could have impacted one or two of those games in the World Series.
You would think so.
Another one that's kind of related, it wasn't a tarp situation from what I understand, and I don't think that there's any photos or anything of it because it was too long ago, but Mickey Mantle kind of famously first, I believe, messed up his knee. He was famous for his terrible knee problems. Chasing down a fly ball somewhere at some field where they had essentially like a grate in the ground and he stepped on it wrong and I guess it just completely tore up his knee.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, of course, they didn't have the same type of surgeries and I guess his career was always sort of hampered after that, even though he still is probably one of the greatest baseball players ever.
Yeah, I think what that did was it really took away a lot of his speed. Mm-hmm. You know, he was kind of a guy along the lines of a Mike Trout, a Willie Mays, mm-hmm. definite five-tool player, and that knee injury I think really did hamper his speed and his base stealing from that point forward. So yeah.
A lot of them seem to happen in baseball. We mentioned the football, but of course the one on field that is probably most infamous that we talked about before we came on the air was Bill Gramatica, who
yes.
tore his ACL after celebrating kicking a field goal.
That was
like
wonderful.
It was like in the first quarter of a game. And the Gramaticas, we should point out, are a family of kickers who are kind of famous for
Martin
over the top.
Is another one.
Yeah, Martin Gramatica.
They're over the top displays of celebrations. So.
Yeah, but
celebrate
yeah.
with your arms. You know,
exactly.
you need those legs.
Right.
Celebrate with your arms. Do all the
high fives.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You can do some gyrations.
Yeah.
You know, some chair dancing.
But, you need that leg. Both yeah. of them, really.
Yeah, exactly.
So well, that's good. In terms of other sports, there are some basketball ones, including and this is a little more off the field, but it is related to Illinois basketball, and that is from the 2004-05 season when Illinois was super good and went 37-2. They didn't have Brian Randall that entire year. He was kind of a wing player. A lot of people may have forgotten about him by now, but he maybe could have played a helping role in the national title game that we lost, but before the season even started, he was angry at a practice and punched the wall and broke his hand or his arm or his wrist or something and sat out that entire year. And so even if you kind of overlook, you know, what he may have been able to do on the floor, you kind of have to feel for the guy in that he wasn't able to participate in that tremendous season.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that I think would have been Randall's sophomore year that he ended up sitting out and taking a redshirt year that year. So, yeah, those are a few examples.
There's plenty more. And if you, dear listener, have some examples and want to send them away, we'll share them on a future podcast.
Absolutely. Or we'll
tweet at us.
Yeah, that's right. We're at Bandwagon Podcast, no vowels, by the way, mm-hmm. and we'll share those out. So that's a look at a few off-the-field and unusual injuries that have afflicted athletes over the years. Let's move on now to someone else who's off the field but plays a big role in sports. That would be commissioners of professional sports. We started talking about this in our meeting last week. We do actually have a planning meeting, believe it or not. We don't just roll in the studio and open up the microphones, although it seems like that sometimes. But commissioners, there are a lot of different types of commissioners. There's Roger Goodell, who rules the NFL with an iron fist. There's Adam Silver in the NBA, who appears to have at least a somewhat better relationship with his players in that league. So I guess kind of the question is about commissioners. Are they really ever popular guys? You know, most of them seem to mostly have critics and detractors, whether that's Bud Selig in baseball, who, you know, was taking a beating a lot of the time, whether it's for the tie in the All-Star game and then the resulting you know, All-Star game deciding home field advantage rule.
Terrible.
I agree. Or whether it's Roger Goodell, who's been, you know, taking a lot of heat for various issues in the National Football League, among them, you know, his kind of one-man player discipline, judge, jury, and appeals process. That's among the things that Goodell takes a beating for.
Gary Bettman in the NHL. Is just every time he comes out, he gets booed.
Yeah.
Well, was he the one – he was sort of presiding over the NHL when NHL essentially – they had that entire lockout year and then ESPN walked away. And so they're I'm sure their audience is much, much smaller than it was in, say, 1994 or something.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about the commissioners a little bit. And Travis, you can probably speak to this too, but it seems to me that over the years – really, there's only been two NBA commissioners since about, you know, the early 80s. But both David Stern and Adam Silver seem to be at least reasonably popular guys with fans, with players. There seems to be a pretty good overall relationship there.
Stern was commissioner for so long. I believe he wanted to hit exactly 30 years when he retired a couple of years ago. So I think his – like he came in with Jordan. Mm-hmm. So that kind of worked out well for him.
Yeah,
you know, Jordan raised all boats, including the commissioner of the NBA. But he's a little more mixed. He was one of the things he was more well known for, kind of in the early 2000s, I think, was the dress code that he made players use. He felt that a lot of the corporate sponsors and big money folks were not crazy about players showing up in do-rags and retro NBA jerseys or whatever. And so he kind of instituted this clothing ban. It wasn't a ban, I guess, but I guess
requirements.
It was a ban. Do we have to talk about what a ban is and what a ban isn't? But that has actually become kind of its own thing now. Like the fashion of the NBA is a very real sort of cultural entity that exists. So it's kind of interesting how that's sort of flipped. But Adam Silver is still relatively new and people love him for any number of reasons. The kind of the main one being that they have avoided any chance of a lockout. They just signed a new CBA with the Players Association, signing with the owners, I believe, through like 2022. Because that was going to come due, I believe, next summer. So they're avoiding, you know, they're going another 5 or 6 years avoiding lockouts. So that was good for them. And there's talk of expansion, but he's still relatively new. And, you know, somebody like Selig encountered a lot more problems. And Goodell has just been, you know, rife with just week after week, the Ray Rice and everything else that kind of came from that.
Yeah, let's talk about baseball, John. And, you know, Rob Manfred is the new commissioner. He's been in the job about 2 years, took over in January of 2015. And I don't know that anybody really has a big opinion either way on Rob Manfred at this point.
Yeah, you got to go through contract negotiations. You've got to go through before people really judge you harshly. But, I mean, he does seem to be trying to do some things that ruffle sort of some older feathers, like move the game along faster. I'd say that's sort of his biggest impact so far, is not really making any huge differences, but talking about a pitch clock, and now they're talking about putting people on second base and extra innings. And I mean, I know those are coming from a rules committee or whatever, but it's really the commissioner who wears that. But Bud Selig, I mean, I think Bud Selig has three huge strikes against him. One is you mentioned the tie game fiasco that on national TV. There's a famous picture of him like standing there like, what are we doing?
I don't know. And it just happened to be in Milwaukee where he was the owner
for so long.
And then the baseball strike that killed the dream Expos White Sox World Series.
Brutal.
But, I mean, that killed baseball for a while. And then, of course, keeping the whole steroid thing under the table and pretending like it didn't happen and then acting all sanctimonious about it, you know, years later, whatever, when the roosters came back to whatever the saying is. I'm not good with
the hens came back to roost.
The roosters came back to hen. But you know what I mean? So he does not seem well liked by the population in general and also, I think, the players. But I will tell you, I think the owners, and this is what makes, you know, we can talk about Goodell too. Really, the commissioner, I think their primary purpose is to serve as the enforcement wing of the owners and be the public face of oftentimes the bad stuff that the owners have to do collectively that they don't want to have to be like, you know, they don't want to take the heat. So, and I think that's especially the case with Goodell. But, you know, I think that, you know, the it wasn't like Bud Selig was the one that decided to send everyone on strike. It was the owners. But, you know, Selig wears it because he was the commissioner.
Selig also, and this should be said for all of the recent commissioners, oversaw a huge influx in terms of money that came into the league. The owners are much happier. The TV contracts are just ridiculous. I know, for instance, and then on the NBA side, Adam Silver, there was a recent evaluation of how much all the teams are worth now, and like most of the teams are worth over $1 billion.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's similar to what's going on in baseball and the NFL as well.
Right. The NFL, obviously. I remember when I was young and the Bears were good, Jim McMahon famously had a tete-a-tete with Pete Rozelle.
Yeah, the headband.
He wore a headband because Pete Rozelle was trying to tell him not to wear certain things. Couldn't wear an Adidas headband, right?
Yeah, so he wore the headband that said Rozelle.
Yeah. So, I mean, the NFL has a history of, commissioners who I think rub people the wrong way. But Goodell, by far and away, is probably the most famous commissioner and definitely the one who brings the most ire probably in the history. He also, like you said, the NFL has gone from being very popular to basically, probably the other than soccer, the biggest money-making sport in the world. Kudos to him for that. But, you've got the domestic abuse thing, and he was always good friends with the Patriots owner, Kraft.
Mm-hmm. Until?
Until. now everybody in Boston hates him because of Deflategate, and there was all that awkwardness at the Super Bowl because the Patriots, in case you didn't know, the Patriots won the Super Bowl, and it was...
What? They were down 28 to... They were down 28 to 3. Are you sure?
That was it. I just turned it off, and I was like, I'm not even going to read any... everyone loved it. Everyone in New England loved how awkward it was for Roger Goodell to have to glad hand with the Pats.
Yeah, yeah. So can you believe this blows my mind? I didn't think it'd been this long. Goodell's been the commissioner for almost 11 years.
Wow.
06 is when he took over.
So who was commissioner before him?
Paul Tagliabue.
Oh, that's right, Tagliabue. Yeah.
Yeah, Tagliabue, just to me, I don't really think much of him either way. He was just kind of a guy to me who kind of stayed out of the way and.
Right. NFL probably actually grew the most during his tenure, though. I mean, it's grown huge in the last 10 years, excepting maybe the last year where they're starting to see some drops for lots of reasons. But, yeah, I mean, the position of commissioner is interesting. We actually talked, and we haven't really talked about, we've only focused on professional commissioners, but you also have commissioners of leagues in college.
Yeah.
And the Big Ten Commissioner Jim Delaney has a pretty sterling reputation in terms of the amount of revenue that he's brought into the Big Ten in his tenure, for sure, right?
Yeah, that's
the Big Ten network.
Yeah, that's been huge. Yeah, and Delaney really was the first commissioner to really push for that. And he also has expanded the league, and I forget how long he's been the commissioner. He took over, I think, in the mid to late 80s. So he was there even when Penn State joined the league.
Right.
Back in 1990, which was the first expansion of the league.
I remember everyone thought that was crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And now for me, it's hard to imagine the league without Penn State. Rutgers and Nebraska, maybe not so much. Yeah. But Penn State, has become really a fixture in the Big Ten Conference. So, yeah, he's overseen that, the Big Ten network really changed in a lot of ways the landscape of college sports, because now most major conferences have or are developing their own network. You've even got Texas that has their own network.
Yeah, I believe the Texas one may have shut down, got major kind of money problems. It's obviously not the same as hosting 14 teams if you're trying to put out content just for one team, even as popular as Texas is, I think I read there were some problems going on.
Okay. That very well could be. I don't have the Longhorn Network.
Right.
I'm not aware of whatever issues they might be having. But yeah, Delaney is, if not the most powerful guy in college sports, he's certainly one of the two or three most powerful.
Right. And, that goes beyond the fact that, the SEC is probably the dominant football conference, and the Big Ten goes back and forth between being maybe dominant in basketball and football, and not so much this year, not a very dominant in college basketball. But the commissioners of the ACC and Pac-10 don't seem to make as huge of an impact.
Yeah, is the SEC guy, is that Mike Slive?
Yeah.
Is he the SEC commissioner?
And he was an attorney, I believe, and I think he's got some kind of connections to Illinois through any number of the problems that we had here in the 80s, 90s, I believe.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I think
not a happy name,
what we're discovering is the bottom line with being commissioner is, are you making lots of money for whatever organization you run?
Very bottom line.
Mm-hmm. So it's an extremely bottom line business. I think if the NFL keeps contracting, or it's not really contracting, but if, let's say, the NFL 5 years from now has contracted quite a bit, and I guarantee Godot would not be there.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's weathered a lot that probably a lot of people thought he should have gone away, but that's because they keep printing money.
Yeah. And actually, you know, as a result of we talked a little bit about Gary Bettman before. I am really surprised that he was never replaced at some point from the NHL, just because the lockout we mentioned, it happened, again, this surprises me that it was this long ago. It was the 04-05 season that saw the entire season canceled. I don't know how you survive that as an owner, where you've got a whole season with no revenue coming in, no TV money, no ticket sales, no nothing.
Well, it hurt him. It hurt the league. I mean, I think NHL took a big step backwards. They've been lucky the last 5 or 6 years with the Blackhawks and some other marquee teams.
A lot of young stars came at the right time.
Yeah, but I think it could be a lot bigger if that hadn't happened. One day we should talk about how you get to become a commissioner, because I'm interested in, like, it seems like law.
Yeah, be a white guy.
Yeah,
and be a prominent lawyer.
Be good at raising money.
Yeah, and have some connection to the sport.
Didn't Condoleezza Rice want to be the NFL commissioner one day?
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Then there's Roger Goodell, though, who basically, I think he was an attorney, but he basically came up the ranks in the NFL. He started working for the league like back in the early 80s when he was just a young lad.
There's an interesting article I read about him. I should find that and print it, but it seemed like Tagliabue was grooming him from the get-go.
Yeah, so that's a little look at the commissioners around major sports and a little bit into college as well. Let's move on here, guys, to a bit of an ownership discussion about the Utah Jazz. Travis, bring us up to speed. What exactly happens?
Yes, Travis, bring us up to speed, because I'm really confused. It's like, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Talk into your microphone, John.
I shared a couple of stories with you guys in order to try to help figure this out, but I am no taxation expert, and also
why not?
Also, I haven't seen, and nobody is really privy to seeing the exact language that's in this situation going on in Utah. So basically, the Utah Jazz are an NBA team. They were owned for about 30 years or so by a guy named Larry H. Miller. He was a car salesman. He bought the team. Full out, 100% owner himself as of, I think, sometime in the 80s. He owned the team. He owns all this other stuff. He owns a baseball team. He owns some real estate. He owns some, like, financial services companies. He died during the 2008-09 season. Actually, when I was a PR intern is when he died. He died, like, right around my birthday when I was there. And then so his wife and his son helped run the team. Gail, his widow, has turned the ownership from just being her and the family, or whatever it really officially was, to now what is called a legacy trust. Basically, that means that ownership of the team is going to be run by a group of trustees. The group of trustees is going to be six people who are all members of the family. And through different tax reasons, it's going to remain in that trust for, according to Utah law, potentially up to 1,000 years.
Wow.
So 1,000 years from now, the Utah Jazz may or may not be playing basketball games, more than likely in Salt Lake City. All the profits of the trust stay within the trust. And although Gail is the official trustee right now, after a short amount of time, maybe it's a few months, maybe it's a couple of years, it will be passed on to this board of six people. And then any major decisions that the Jazz make will have to be done with either a majority or a supermajority of those six people. Like, for instance, if they wanted to move the team, if they wanted to take out some of the money, they would have to go through the board on that.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
So, and I'm curious, it sounds like there's at least some similarity here to, say, the Green Bay Packers ownership situation, which I believe, you have basically a bunch of shareholders that own that team. It's not an individual owner, again, for the Packers. So it sounds like at least there's a bit of similarity there, although, yeah, I'm not as intimately familiar with Green Bay's situation to know exactly what could be done as far as, you know, selling the team or anything like that, whether it's a majority of stockholders or what it would be. But it sounds like this might be a good solution for a smaller market team, you know, in a market where, let's be honest, somebody could come in from the outside, buy up the team, and decide they wanted to move it, yeah. And there really wouldn't be much that could be done about it. This sounds like a solution that, at least for the, you know, fairly distant future, makes sure that if there's an NBA team, and, you know, that it stays right there in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, and really the difference here between what you talked about with Green Bay and Utah is that Utah is still going to be staying with the Miller family. So mm-hmm. they are of the Latter-day Saint faith,
sure. Yeah.
And so they've got a lot of children and grandchildren all over the place, and so they're pretty confident that the Miller family is going to continue to exist, essentially,
sure,
and that they're going to have some kind of say over what happens with the team. Green Bay, I mean, a lot of that's just mostly just straight up fans, is it not?
And then I think
they
so.
Kind of appoint a trustee in a similar way, I'm sure, or maybe like a general manager type person, but. They are similar and yet they are different, is
yeah.
what I would say.
Yeah. Just thinking about, you know, some of the other teams that we've seen relocate here fairly recently. You know, in the NFL, you had the team leave St. Louis, the Rams, and go to L.A. You've seen San Diego leave and, again, go to L.A. Mm-hmm. The Raiders are on their way to Las Vegas, it looks like.
Some of those are interesting, especially those NFL ones, because they're still the same owner. It's typically like when a team gets a new owner,
yeah.
all of a sudden that team and that team base is like, oh, does that mean we're going to move to Vegas or Los Angeles or something? We talked about the Milwaukee Bucks a while ago. They have some recent change in their ownership. They had a senator, Herb Cole, was their owner for a long time, and then they got some New York City big money folks, and people thought maybe they're going to move them somewhere else. Potentially, I don't know where else, but somewhere. And it turned out that didn't happen in their case, but that's typically what you see. And so those NFL teams, the Chargers, I guess, going to LA from San Diego. I mean, that owner has been in that city for 50 years or something, and he's just kind of picking up and moving.
Yeah, I think the stadium was the big issue there for San Diego. Yeah. They couldn't get a new stadium where they were, and so they, you know, followed the money there to L.A. And it's a similar situation to Oakland for the Raiders. They couldn't yeah. get a new stadium deal there.
Didn't the one in Las Vegas fall through, though, a bit?
You know, I have not kept up on that very, very much,
it's
I have
very
to admit.
Exciting. Seat of the pants
stuff. Did kind of. Fall through. I'm not
Did it?
Sure either.
So are they the Raiders staying?
I don't think they want to. Yeah, that's the weird thing.
I think
thing,
it's kind of right? up in the air, really.
Oh, man. All this stuff is weird. Like, you know, yeah. Seattle moving to Oklahoma, that happened a long time ago, but that still seems kind of fresh.
Yeah, that's been 15 years ago, I think,
oh
or so
God.
that happened.
I'm getting old.
Like nine, I
Oh,
think?
Was it? It was only yeah. nine? Okay, so not as long ago as I thought. But
yeah. that was an unusual situation where a team was moved from a bigger city to a smaller city, but, you know, like, it's worked out well for Oklahoma City, not so much for Seattle. But
Yeah. And, you know, the one league that really hasn't had a relocation in quite a while is Major League Baseball, the last one being, you know, the Expos moving to Washington,
yeah.
which I think was in 05, 04, 05, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about Bud Selig and contraction. A little callback to our earlier conversation. I forgot about that. That was terrible. I was in Minneapolis at the time, and they were talking about contracting the Twins and the Expos.
Yeah. And as it ended up, you know, neither team was contracted. Minnesota stayed where they were, and then eventually got their new stadium.
Oh, imagine that!
Yeah. And, you know, there's
beautiful. By the way, I don't know if you guys have been there.
Yeah,
very
I've been
nice.
To Target Field. It is a nice
very
stadium.
Nice.
I don't see how could it be better than the Metrodome. That was the best place to ever see a baseball game.
I've seen a game in both places.
And a wrestling match and a football game.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and
sorry.
And probably a NASCAR
I
event.
Digressed a little bit. But, yeah, that's interesting, that whole idea of contraction. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So Bud still has probably that as, you know, a lot of people remember that as his part of his legacy as well. So anyway, back to this, you know, the Utah ownership situation. Looks like the Jazz has some stability now with that situation. I wonder if we'll see some other small market teams, you know, that are owned by a family like that, if you'll see somebody who really wants the team to stay in that location, if you'll see something similar, say in a city the size of a Portland, you know, of a Charlotte. So, Charlotte's growing pretty big, I should say, but you know, maybe a New Orleans or you know something like that where
interesting ideas.
Yeah, where the market isn't that big, where you know they might be afraid that someone will come in and move the team.
And I think kind of the situation that Utah has that really allows them to do this is sort of a little bit based in their religion because they are Latter-day Saints and they just – they have a lot of family. I mean I saw a picture of their entire family. It's like 40 people standing there all under the age of like 40. So they know that they are going to have some – you know, a group of people in a family that can take care of that. It's a little different where you might have a single owner. Like you might have Paul Allen who was originally a key founding member of Microsoft and he's the owner of the Blazers. I mean he's super rich and he could pass something along to whatever his family is under him. But I don't know what if he's going to have the same confidence that the Paul Allen family is going to be the same as the Millers do. They have a lot of confidence there. Another single owner of local relevance is Shad Khan.
Yeah.
He's the 100% owner of both the Jacksonville Jaguars and Fulham, I believe, yeah. In the EPL. That would sort of be interesting to see if he passes those along to his kids. I know Tony works for the team, and he's got a daughter as well. But that would just be interesting to kind of see what happens there.
Yeah. So interesting stuff with the Utah Jazz ownership situation. Let's stay in the state of Utah. It is rivalry time. All right, Travis, lay it on us. What do we have today?
This is all Utah, all the time.
The most Utah talk we've ever had on the bandwagon.
Yeah. And probably I don't imagine we're going to come back to this subject a whole lot. So let's get it all in now, people. So the rivalry, if you have any kind of knowledge of the state of Utah, this is really the only rivalry in the state, and that is the University of Utah versus BYU. It's called the Holy War. For a reason, as we've just been discussing, the Mormon population in Utah is the highest in the world. That's where the church is based. That's how all the streets are, like, based off of each other. Like, if you're at 400 East and 600 South, that means you're 6 blocks south and 4 blocks east of the church.
The tabernacle.
So that is literally the center of the LDS church. Both schools have a lot of LDS students, but the University of Utah does not necessarily have all LDS students,
right.
If that makes sense.
It's a public university, right?
Right. Yeah, it is funded by the state, and BYU is funded by the church. BYU is in Provo, which is just south of Salt Lake City, and University of Utah is in Salt Lake City. Provo is slightly interesting because the county in which it is, which I believe is called Utah County, is like literally like 97% Mormon. It's like I'm not doing an alternative fact here. Like it's
wow.
Literally like above 90% Mormon. It's just that's where you go if you are a member of the LDS Church. Obviously, as with any good rivalry, they have kind of differing views on what the records are versus each other. Like BYU claims that they have a certain number of wins and Utah claims a different number. I don't really know what to make of that other than I think that that's just a good sign of a good rivalry. Like people want to argue about what's there and what's not. And then kind of the most timely part of this rivalry is from a basketball game they had. Looks like it was a couple years ago. Larry Kriskoviak is still, I believe, the coach at Utah, and he was concerned about some chippiness and the way that the players were interacting with each other during a previous game, and so he sort of unilaterally canceled the game that was going to be played in January of 2016.
Wow.
And that was the first time, I guess, that they hadn't played since World War II. And then football also did something similar, but I believe that is going to pick up – that football rivalry is going to pick up next year.
So they don't do basketball at all anymore?
I think they just canceled that individual game.
Okay. All right.
I'd have to go through their schedules to see if they played this year, but they've played a lot of games versus each other. It's obviously – it's all anybody talks about there because if you're like a non-LDS person living there, you're likely to be a Utah fan. And if you're a Mormon, you may or may not be a BYU fan. So it really is the holy war.
So it's called the holy war because one team is super – LDS and the other team is only like primarily
right. Right.
Utah is not as religious as BYU.
Right. Still religious, just not as religious. And I don't think that it goes as far as like the what was the Catholics versus the convicts. I don't think it's anything like Notre Dame versus say Miami in the 80s. Although I have no idea what the religious makeup is of the University of Miami, but I imagine it's not quite the same as what Notre Dame is.
Well, if that ESPN 30 for 30 tells me anything, then the religion wasn't so important.
Yeah. Just a good tagline for a nice T-shirt.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
good way to make $20.
I just looking here on the authoritative source Wikipedia on the rivalry, there's a game, a football game from 1998, that is called the Doink Heard Round Utah.
That's interesting.
It was a field goal that bounced off the upright as time expired and was no good.
Oh, man.
The poor Utes came up short.
Utes Cougars. That's your matchup.
Utes and
Cougars. Rivalry.
So anyway, that's our rivalry here today. Thank you very much, Travis.
Sure.
All right, status update time. Time to discuss what we've seen on social media here this week that's caught our eye. John Steinbacher.
Well, let's just stay out west for a while. I mean, we need to build our audience out on the west coast.
Yeah, we need a bigger audience in
Utah, California.
California. So last week, or was it maybe, last week, high school sophomore LaMelo Ball of Chino Hills scored 92 points in a game in a 146-123 victory over visiting Los Osos. I'm probably not saying that right. Older brother LiAngelo is the team's leading scorer, but he sat out. So he scored 92 points and made national headlines. And as we often see with these kind of things, a couple years ago, there was a guy at a college that's over somewhere in Illinois that scored like 136 points in a game or something.
Yeah.
If you look at the footage, LaMelo was basically cherry picking almost the whole game. It was super fast paced.
Almost never crossed half court.
Yeah, exactly.
Really bad.
It's not like Kobe's 83 or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
81. Yeah. But I don't know. It's just interesting. He's also, of course, the younger brother of
Lonzo,
UCLA super freshman, right? And both LaMelo and his older brother, who sat out, are also planning. Have already committed to UCLA. So, anyway, it's just interesting. And I don't know. I don't think it's very sporting, but good for him for getting the headlines.
Yeah, there you go. All right, John. Thank you, Travis. What do you got for us?
Also basketball related, but not college. And not high school, and not the NBA, and not even the D League.
Mm.
There's a new league called the Big Three.
Oh, yeah.
It's a 3-on-3 league, basically, with a bunch of former NBA players, guys like some names that I pulled. Chauncey Billups, who won NBA Finals MVP 1 year with the Pistons. Jason Williams, with all the fancy behind-the-back passes and stuff. Kenyon Martin, former...
White chocolate.
Yeah, white chocolate. Kenyon Martin, former number one overall draft pick. Steven Jackson, who famously said, "I make love to pressure." just overall great, hilarious guy. But another player in that league is expected to be Brian Cook, former Illinois star, Big Ten Player of the Year.
Lincoln native, Brian
Lincoln
Cook.
Illinois native. And he... his name was among the list that I saw one of the NBA reporters tweet out. And when I retweeted that person's link, I got, I believe, a like and a retweet from the one and only Brian Cook.
Hey.
Congratulations.
How about that?
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Isn't Ice Cube?
Ice Cube?
I think it's Cube.
Ice Cube. It could be Ice Cube. He's a part of the league. He's a commissioner, maybe.
Is it
talking commissioner?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's the commissioner.
Wow, that'd be something.
One thing I would say about that league, I'm really excited about it, but mostly because I just want to see how fast it takes those people to get injured. Because that was always my favorite part about like the old timers game.
Oh, there goes his Achilles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess the 3-on-3 format is trying to
limit how much they run. Is it going to be half court?
It's got to be half court. Make it, take it.
People,
right, yeah.
People over 40, full court 3-on-3, that would not be
good. Yeah.
All right, so that's what Travis has. I will round things out. Of course, it's spring training time, and that means all the stories you get every year about best shape of his life, about big changes that somebody's made in their game, and the one that's coming to the forefront as the Cubs come to spring training, Jason Hayward, who... was great defensively last year for the Cubs, but man, he could not hit his way out of a paper bag. I've seen all sorts of detailed articles about he's been working on his swing all off season. That they're optimistic that the bat's going to come around. The best of those articles actually was just released this morning, I believe, by Sahadev Sharma from The Athletic in Chicago. Very detailed article with all sorts of, you know,
the biomechanics of what he's doing
with,
or something?
With gifts of his swing, like in 2012 when he had a good year, and last year when he was struggling, and some things that somebody shot when he was working out in Arizona. So you got all this video and everything embedded in there. We'll see if any of it actually works out. But boy, it's fun to read about it here as we get set for baseball.
So when he was with the Cardinals, he did struggle a lot of that year, but he also had a long stretch where he was super good.
Second half of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just hard to tell what you're going to get.
If he comes out slow, people are going to lay it on him.
Also, is this only a spring training thing where they're talking about Schwarber playing catcher? Or are they actually going to do it when, you know, it's May, June, July, August?
Well, the basically what I read was that they're going to look at him there this spring and go from there, where he might be the third catcher.
That's a good option to have.
Yeah, you know, he's not going to catch a lot because they have Contreras to be kind of the main guy. They have Miguel Montero still to be the backup. And Schwarber could be like the guy they put there, you know, in a double switch in the ninth inning. Or maybe he'll start once every couple of weeks back there if he's up for it. But you're talking about a guy who blew out an ACL less than a year ago.
Yeah.
So we'll see. All right, that's going to wrap things up for this edition of The Bandwagon. And even though Lisa was not here with us for the show, she is here for the credits. Take it away, Lisa.
Today's Bandwagon podcast was produced by Brian Moline, Lisa Braltz, and John Steinbucker. There are other people who have helped make Bandwagon the entity that you are hearing every so often, despite the odds. Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman, Taylor Judd, the band REM, and you. Especially you, listeners. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon, where we link to almost everything we discuss here, if we can remember it. That includes video, audio. You can also subscribe to this podcast and rate it in iTunes. Rating us really helps people discover the podcast, so help us out. It's not just iTunes either. You can find us pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcast. Don't put any vowels in there or you're going to be following something else entirely. To get our most recent thoughts on stuff. And we do all have our own Twitter accounts too, so you can follow us there if you want to as well. If you're feeling good about Bandwagon and our home station, Illinois Public Media, throw us a bone at willpledge.org, why don't you? And mention us in the comments. And again, thanks for listening.